Chapter 9. Deadly Violence. Willem van Spronson. The Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, Washington, is fully gated off and located on the outskirts of the city. The detention center is privately operated by GEO Group on behalf of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, making it the frequent target of left-wing activists from Seattle who oppose the Trump administration's position on border security. By driving there from out of town, I was retracing some of the final steps that Willem van Spronson took when he launched a fatal attack on the facility in 2019. On the early hours of July 13, 2019, the 69-year-old carpenter drove to the facility armed with a rifle and a stash of incendiary devices. At around 4 a.m., van Spronson hurled firebombs at the property and cars parked on the street. One vehicle blew up and was completely engulfed in flames. Four officers from the Tacoma Police Department responded to the attack after GEO staff called 911. When they got there, van Spronson allegedly tried to ignite a 500-gallon propane tank that was attached to one of the facility's buildings. "Shots fired," was reported, and police shot van Spronson dead. No one else suffered injuries in the terrorist attack. The firebombing of the ICE facility came during years of heightened hostility from the American left in response to Trump's promises to crack down on illegal migration. In summer 2018, Antifa and far-left extremists in Portland besieged the local ICE facility for more than a week. After the facility was retaken by federal officers from the Department of Homeland Security, Antifa created an adjacent autonomous zone on city property. In August 2019, two ICE buildings in San Antonio, Texas, were hit with bullets in a drive-by shooting. "Had the bullets gone 2 inches in another direction, we could be here today talking about the murder of a federal official," said Christopher Combs, special agent in charge of the FBI's San Antonio division at the time. The same month, protesters threatened employees of GEO Group in Florida, where they are headquartered. "We know where all your children live throughout the country," one protester shouted in video published by Breitbart News. "We know everything about you, and you won't just be seeing us here," another person screamed. "We know where you sleep at night." With the escalating rhetoric used by left-wing protesters against immigration and border protection officers, I feared it would only be a matter of time before someone would try to kill them. The graffiti I saw at the Occupy ICE Portland Autonomous Zone used dehumanizing language against ICE staff. Some plainly called for ICE agents to be killed. When I first saw van Spronson's photo online in a news article, I recognized him, but I couldn't recall how. Having been to so many protests and riots over the years, I picked my brain to remember. It finally came to me, Seattle City Hall in late 2018. On December 1st, 2018, I had traveled to Seattle to cover the far-left protest against the Washington Three Percenters, a conservative group that promotes limited government. Antifa and other left-wing activists wrongly branded the group fascists because its name is similar to another group that was at Unite the Right in Charlottesville, Virginia. When I attempted to record the left-wing protesters that day, I was accosted and surrounded. They backed me up against a barrier and screamed at me and shoved signs in my face. Two people who confronted me were openly carrying semi-automatic rifles. I later learned they were members of the Puget Sound John Brown Gun Club, a regional affiliate of Redneck Revolt. One man confronted me inches from my face. With bloodshot eyes, he leaned into me and calmly said, "I'm known to do this shit for real. Some of us didn't really come to talk. Some of us came to die, dude. Are you willing to die for YouTube shit? Death is going to come. Death is coming for you, dude. You spying and doing this punk shit? It's going to get you hurt. I didn't know who he was at the time, but perhaps he recognized me. I later learned he was an ardent supporter of Antifa in both Seattle and Portland. He has photographs of himself with Rose City Antifa members on his Facebook page. I reported the threat to Seattle police, but nothing ever happened. Besides heated screams and yells from left-wing protesters, police kept the rallies peaceful. Before I left, one elderly man walked up and stood by me for a moment. He looked to be in his 60s or 70s, much older than the average protester there. He was wearing a hat with the abbreviation JBGC for the John Brown Gun Club. That man was Willem van Spronsen. I never had any concerns about his mental health. Yassine, a 34-year-old Seattle area defense attorney and former friend of van Spronsen, tells me. Yassine, not his real name, knew van Spronsen from their time together in the Puget Sound John Brown Gun Club. Yassine had a prominent role in the group. I think it's fair to say the group is militant, he says. I was excited to see a left-wing organization that supported gun rights. Yassine describes his politics as libertarian anarchist. He also used to be a member of the National Lawyers Guild, the far-left legal organization that provides legal aid to extreme left-wing individuals and causes. Outside of their social activities, the Puget Sound John Brown Gun Club members volunteered as security for left-wing events. Many of those gatherings involved Antifa Black Bloc militants engaging in criminal direct action. But Yassine says the gun club's members were never involved in those activities. He says their philosophy on left-wing criminal activity was simple. If we don't see it, it doesn't exist. That view echoes a chant by Antifa Black Bloc when their comrades engage in arson or vandalism. We didn't see shit. In December 2018, Yassine, van Spronsen, and other members of the Puget Sound John Brown Gun Club provided security for the protest outside Seattle City Hall. Yassine didn't know who I was, but he saw the way I was treated by some of his club's co-members who were armed. He says my political views are irrelevant. Anyone has a right to be on the public street and record what they witness. He raised his concerns internally with the club's members. They disagreed with him and didn't want to be seen as critiquing a member of their own community. Frustrated with their decision, he resigned from the organization. I asked Yassine about van Spronsen. I wanted to know who he really was behind all the Antifa propaganda that branded him a brave martyr. Yassine simply describes van Spronsen as a calm old man who suffered from chronic pain and was dealing with child custody issues from his ex-wife Shelley. She accused him of domestic abuse and was granted protective orders by a court. Beyond his personal issues, van Spronsen was deeply committed to left-wing causes and had been active in far-left protests for many years. Van Spronsen was a naturalized immigrant from Holland who lived in Vashon, an island in the Puget Sound west of Seattle. He was well known in the anarchist and Antifa community. Toward the end of his life, he turned to militant, violent direct action. The year before his deadly attack, he was arrested at the same Tacoma detention center when he assaulted an officer at a protest for open borders. Court documents say van Spronsen jumped on an officer and wrapped his arms around his neck, as if in an attempt to choke him. Van Spronsen was eventually subdued, arrested, and found to be carrying a knife and baton. During one of his court appearances, he gave a Black Power fist salute to his comrades in the gallery. He ultimately pleaded guilty to a lesser charge of obstructing police. Before his deadly attack, van Spronsen sent a printed manifesto to his friends. In it, he wrote the iconic words, "I am Antifa," and referred to ICE facilities as concentration camps. The latter was popularized by New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez the month prior to the attack. He also made a reference to Bella Ciao, an Italian song from World War II, often sung by Antifa and other left-wing protesters today. Van Sponsen's manifesto read in part, "I am Antifa. I stand with comrades around the world who act from the love of life in every permutation. Comrades who understand that freedom means real freedom for all and a life worth living. Keep the faith. All power to the people. Bella Ciao." The semi-automatic weapon I used was a cheap, home-built, unregistered Ghost AR-15. It had 6 magazines. I strongly encourage comrades and incoming comrades to arm themselves. We are now responsible for defending people from the predatory state. Ignore the law in arming yourself if you have the luxury. I did. Van Sponsen's friends did not report his manifesto to the police. In response to news of his death, Antifa groups around the world issued eulogies. "When our good friend and comrade Willem Van Sponsen took a stand against the fascist detention center in Tacoma, he became a martyr who gave his life to the struggle against fascism. He was kind and deeply loved by many communities. We cannot let his death go unanswered," the Seattle Anti-Fascist Action wrote on Facebook. Antifa in Washington State and Oregon organized memorials, including one near the scene of the attack. They held banners that read, "Rest in Power" and "Fire to the Prisons." In Exarchia, a neighborhood in Athens, Greece, home to many Antifa and left-wing radicals, a mural of Van Sponsen was painted along with a quote from José Buenaventura Durruti de Monge, the Spanish Civil War-era anarchist insurrectionist. Van Sponsen's failed attack on the Tacoma ICE facility remains one of the higher-profile incidents of Antifa violence, even though apologists say it doesn't count because he was the only one killed. To that, I say the failure of a terrorist attack doesn't exonerate the perpetrator. During my visit to the Northwest Detention Center, I walked around outside and found multiple bullet holes from the shooting. Investigators marked off the evidence with measurements. A staff member guided me around and showed me where Van Sponsen's body was found. There was a stain there. I don't know if it was related to the attack. Nearby, the windows of one of the buildings he firebombed were still broken. Next to it stood an empty spot on the building's exterior that looked recently tampered with. The staff person said that's where the propane tank was. We may never know if Van Sponsen's goal was to commit suicide by cop or if he wanted to take others out with him. Yassine takes pity on his late friend. "He seemed like Don Quixote. He was fighting windmills." I view Van Sponsen not as a martyr, but rather the victim of a hateful ideology that consumed him. Antifa's worldview, taken to its logical conclusion, results in the death of not just its adherents, but sometimes also those unfortunate enough to be around them. It's most effective at exploiting those who have grievances. Van Sponsen appeared to blame the state for siding with his ex-wife's domestic violence allegations. A year after his attack, I still occasionally see Van Sponsen's name, face, or manifesto evoked at events where Antifa or the far left are present. The Puget Sound John Brown Gun Club has refused to disassociate from its late member. In fact, the group relishes in the association and has been disseminating his manifesto in print when they table at events. In November 2019, a member of the group was part of an Antifa protest of a Dinesh D'Souza event in Portland where I was a guest speaker. When I came outside the venue to see what was happening, a man I recognized as being one of the group's members approached me and handed me Van Sponsen's printed manifesto. I'm not sure if I should have interpreted the act as threatening. The booklet had an illustration of a burning ice van. Nick Vasili, another member of the gun club, wears a rifle round that belonged to Van Spronson as a necklace. They're proud of what he did. Charlie Landeros. Many remember Van Spronson's firebombing because it was the first known time an attacker left behind a manifesto explicitly stating his ties to Antifa. But he wasn't actually the first, or unfortunately the last, to carry out deadly violence inspired by Antifa. In fact, 6 months earlier, an Antifa extremist in Eugene, Oregon, carried out a failed shooting on resource officers at a middle school. He was a smart, loving, intelligent person who turned into a monster, Shayla Landeros tells me. She's the ex-wife of Charles Landeros, 30, who went by Charlie. They divorced years before his fatal armed attack on January 11th, 2019, at Cascade Middle School, but remained in close contact because of their two daughters. Charlie didn't start out like a lot of the other Antifa. He was born in Hong Kong to a Mexican-American Christian missionary father and a Filipino mother. Shayla met him when they were in high school in Eugene, a college town in central Oregon. When he was 17, he enlisted in the army. He was stationed for a time in Fort Drum, New York, and served deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan. In 2007, they married. The following year, Shayla gave birth to their second daughter. For a few years, they lived as a family unit, even though he frequently spent long trips abroad, working in helicopter transport services. Shayla says they separated when she learned Charles was having a romantic relationship with another man in the military. Their relationship ended in divorce in 2013. Both of them later relocated back to Eugene from Jacksonville, Florida. In 2014, Charles began a pre-med program at the University of Oregon, UO. He wanted a career change and was interested in becoming a pediatrician. But Shayla says it was during his time at UO that he was introduced to an ideology that twisted him and set him on the path to death. While at UO, Charles began taking an interest in leftist politics and social justice, as many students do. For a time, he worked as a sex educator at UO's sexual wellness advocacy team, where he was introduced to more radical political ideas. He began to advocate for migrant causes in response to then-candidate Trump's statements on illegal migration. He started telling people he was a dreamer, Shayla says, using a term popularized by the DREAM Act, which was a legislative proposal to give permanent residency to those who illegally enter the United States as minors. He started fighting for deferred action for childhood arrivals, under the false pretense he immigrated here. This is not something he would have lied about before. He used to be proud that he was an American. In October 2017, Charles was one of the students who led the stage storming and shutdown of the annual State of the University address by UO's president. On stage, the protesters shouted and screamed about fascism on campus and complained about tuition increases. By that time, Charles was fully indoctrinated in extreme far-left views. Part of that transformation involved changing his gender pronouns. He identified as non-binary and used they-them pronouns. He developed a deep hatred of law enforcement and the military. He co-founded the Community Armed Self-Defense Group, a far-left anti-government organization that teaches oppressed peoples how to use guns. Its Facebook page description echoes a core tenet of Antifa ideology. The police are not here to protect us. Shayla says Charles used the group to radicalize others in the belief that there needed to be an armed, violent revolution. Charles's radicalization continued and accelerated in the final 2 years of his life. By then, he was a full-time activist and was not paying child support. Shayla largely ignored discussing politics with her ex-husband, but his views concerned her when it became clear he was trying to radicalize their two children. She says they were becoming hyper-focused on race and had developed a sudden hatred of police. He was also teaching them how to shoot. We have had several conversations where he proceeds to tell me I wouldn't understand because I'm white and that I have white privilege. Quietly, she was most disturbed about his involvement in the self-defense group. She says he was stockpiling guns. In May 2018, special agents with the FBI stopped by her home to interview her. According to the 25 pages of the FBI investigation into Charles, they received a tip in February 2018 from someone who knew Charles from the army that he had legitimate plans to cause riots and uprisings with the goal of destabilizing local governments. The investigation failed to find that a federal crime had been committed. But for Charles, that was enough for him to shut out most of the people in his life over fears he or they were being monitored. He got rid of his mobile device and stopped visiting his children. He pulled in closer to his group of comrades. Shayla says he was involved in the Eugene Antifa scene and that in one of their few conversations about the FBI investigation, Charles said they were targeting him because he was in Antifa. By late 2018, crisis hit the family. In response, Charles finally returned to see his children. He was no longer driving at this point because he was afraid of registering with the DMV. He got around town with the help of a far-left activist woman he was dating from his self-defense gun group. At the beginning of 2019, Shayla caught her younger daughter sneaking out of the house. After an argument, the daughter called her father and said she wanted to live with him instead. When Charles picked her up, he took down Shayla's American flag that flew in front of the home and burned it. When winter break was over and it was time to take their daughter to the Charter Military Academy, where she was enrolled, he refused. He hated the school's military affiliation and unilaterally withdrew her from attendance to enroll her at a different school. Even though Charles had joint custody of the children, his final divorce decree stated that Shayla has final decision-making authority involving the education of their children. On January 11th, 2019, Shayla brought her custody paperwork to Cascade Middle School. She intended to bring their daughter back to the military academy where she had already been a student. Charles was called to the school to meet with Shayla and an administrator. Per the school district's policy on custody disputes, a school resource officer was also called. About an hour before Charles arrived with his new partner by car, he wrote, "Death to all pigs," on the Facebook page of the Springfield Police Department. 2 days before that, he wrote in another post, "Time to start killing pigs." When Charles returned to the middle school, he was armed with a concealed pistol, a loaded magazine on a gun belt, and additional ammunition in his backpack. He wore a shirt that read, "Smash the Patriarchy." School resource officer Steve Tim met with Shayla and reviewed her custody paperwork. He and another school resource officer, Eugene Police Officer Aaron Johns, informed Charles that he could not be present when Shayla removes their child from the school. Charles refused to leave the property. He stood in the lobby and became belligerent. When Johns tried to escort Charles out of the school and inform him he was under arrest, he resisted and fought the officer. He then took out his handgun and fired twice in the direction of the second officer, narrowly missing him. His daughter was nearby in the lobby and was almost shot during the fight. Charles came prepared and willing to kill police, but he was overcome. Tim fired one round at Charles, striking him in the head and killing him instantly. Within hours, news of Charles's death spread within the Antifa networks in the Pacific Northwest. The Eugene-based Civil Liberties Defense Center, an Antifa legal group that describes itself as an anti-racist social justice organization, immediately took up a case on behalf of Charles. The group released a statement suggesting racism was to blame for the shooting. While people of color comprise 38.5% of the US population, they make up 51.5% of those killed by police, the Civil Liberties Defense Center wrote. The experience of dealing with police in America is different for whites and non-whites. Charlie was of mixed Filipino and Mexican descent. The group asked for donations to fund their investigation. Despite there being no evidence race had anything to do with Charles's death, Antifa networks amplified the copy-paste narrative set by the Civil Liberties Defense Center. They used the hashtag love and rage for Charlie to help promote the campaign. It was lifted from a radical poem authored by Charles titled Love and Rage. Do not let anyone quench your fire. Do not let them dismiss your love nor pacify your rage. My love, do not water yourself down. The poem was authored sometime after he had been radicalized and repeats a theme found in Antifa literature and art: never moderate. In fact, Charles's extremism is what made him respected in the Antifa community in the Pacific Northwest. Portland Antifa group Pop Mob tweeted on January 13, 2019, Charlie Landeros, beloved comrade and street medic, was murdered by Eugene police 2 days ago. They were a non-binary activist of color who did amazing work in their community and were gunned down in front of their children's school. Please support the Civil Liberties Defense Center investigation if you can. American Antifa blog site It's Going Down also posted in support of him and expressed doubt that he even had a gun. Much of what Shayla learned about Antifa came after her ex-husband's death. It was hard for her to recognize the person mentioned in the Antifa's group's eulogies and memorials. But in the last years of his life, he was no longer the man she knew. There are two sides of him, she says. There's the Charlie I married, and then there is the Antifa Charlie. And being at the school during Charles's attack, she says it was absolutely false that he was killed because of police racism. Still, leftist groups and organizers fundraised on behalf of his family based on that accusation. Shayla says none of that money went to his two children. She paid for his funeral and had little contact with his side of the family. Based on the evidence, the investigation conducted by Lane County District Attorney Patricia Perlow failed to find wrongdoing on the part of the school resource officers. Charles came with a gun and fired it at police before he was killed. And against Shayla's wishes, she says the Civil Liberties Defense Center attempted to interview her younger daughter without her present. Their independently funded investigation also failed to produce anything. District Attorney Perlow wrote in her findings released to the media, Eugene police officers Tim and Johns are trainers in active shooter scenarios. Their specialized training as school resource officers allowed them to recognize the potential risks in a custody dispute taking place in a school. They both were appropriate in their determination that Charles Landeros was creating a disturbance at Cascade Middle School and needed to be removed from the premises. When Charles Landeros refused to cooperate, they were justified in making an arrest. Upon making the arrest, their lives and the lives of others were placed in danger by Mr. Landeros physically resisting that arrest, brandishing a firearm and firing it twice. It is unknown why Charles Landeros chose to use deadly force in this circumstance, but he clearly had no regard for the lives of the police officers or the students or staff present, including his child. Officer Tim saved the life of Officer Johns, himself, and perhaps many others, given the number of rounds Charles Landeros had loaded in his weapon. There is no clearer circumstance that the use of deadly force is justified than this. Officer Tim's body cam footage was released to the public. Despite the video exonerating the school resource officers, Antifa have continued to repeat the lie that he was executed by racist cops. 4 days after the district attorney's announcement that she wouldn't bring charges, explosives were left outside Eugene Police Headquarters. They were discovered before they detonated, and a bomb squad was called in to defuse the devices. The attempted bombing remains under investigation, and law enforcement have not released any information since January 2019. Shayla believes the bombing was an act of revenge by Antifa. She has good reason to think so. Charles was connected to a network of militant Antifa who believed in and trained for armed conflict with the state. "This is somebody I cared about and loved, but the way he was going and the way he was headed, he was going to end up this way." Connor Betts. As important as it is to study who revered political martyrs are, their beliefs, writings, biographies, it is just as important to examine who is doing the revering. One man in Ohio who joined the chorus of Antifa in calling William Van Spronson a martyr was 24-year-old Connor Stephen Betts. He went on to carry out his own deadly shooting in a packed commercial Dayton neighborhood on August 4, 2019. He killed 9 people, including his sister, and injured 27 others. Responding police shot him dead within less than a minute. Betts' shooting came within 24 hours of another mass shooting in El Paso, Texas, that shocked the nation. Patrick Crucius killed 23 people, mostly Latinos, at a Walmart. Another 23 suffered injuries. The 21-year-old allegedly left behind a 2,300-word manifesto on internet forum 8chan, espousing racist and white nationalist beliefs. The entire punditry class picked apart Crucius's manifesto word by word to blame the shooting not merely on him, but on President Trump, white people, and every American who supported border security. And before details were known about Betts' political beliefs, his mass shooting was also assumed to be related to white supremacy because he was white. For a few hours, we heard about both El Paso and Dayton and the crisis of white racism. But once it became known that Betts actually espoused militant Antifa views, the Dayton shooting went down the memory hole. Connor Stephen Betts did not leave behind a manifesto, as far as we know, but he was an active Twitter user under name @IAmTheSpookster. Before that account was taken down after the shooting, it provided as clear a view into his beliefs as any manifesto could. Betts was Antifa. In his Twitter biography, a short section for users to describe themselves, he wrote leftist and listed his pronouns. Going through his posts week by week and month by month reveals someone who wasn't just a casual supporter of anti-fascism, but someone who espoused the same language and ideology of Antifa militants. In August 2018, he wrote, "Kill every fascist." This echoes verbatim the graffiti and messaging of Antifa. His tweets throughout 2018 and 2019 became increasingly violent. "Hey, if you're Nazi-friendly or adjacent, fucking unfollow me, 'cause Nazis deserve death and nothing else," he tweeted in October 2018. Betts frequently flung the label Nazi at those with whom he disagreed online and adopted the black and white Antifa view that if you're not anti-fascist, you are pro-fascist. By December 2018, he wrote to the Socialist Rifle Association, SRA, another Antifa-allied gun group, to inquire about bump stocks. A bump stock is an attachment for semi-automatic rifles that allows them to fire faster. Betts expressed a longing for climactic confrontation. In response to an essay by left-wing Intercept writer Mehdi Hassan titled, "Yes, Let's Defeat or Impeach Trump, But What If He Doesn't Leave the White House?" Betts wrote, "Arm, train, prepare." In June 2019, Betts tweeted, "I want socialism, and I'll not wait for the idiots to finally come round understanding." On the day of Willem van Spronsen's terrorist attack, Betts called him a martyr. In line with Antifa views, Betts had a cosmic hatred for border security and ICE. "Cut the fences down, slice ICE tires, throw bolt cutters over the fences," he wrote in a tweet. In the week leading up to his shooting, he retweeted posts that referred to US migrant detention centers as concentration camps, again repeating what Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez and Van Spronsen had said. Other posts he shared eulogize Van Spronsen as an elder comrade. And also illuminating is who Betts was repeating and interacting with on Twitter. He frequently shared posts from freelance writer Kim Kelly. The frequent Teen Vogue contributor has written an essay on the far left embracing guns. She's also authored a glowing profile of anarchists and argued many times on abolishing prisons. She referred to Van Spronsen as a comrade. And in a now-deleted tweet, she defended him and called for others to take inspiration from his attack. As Van Spronsen and the many other heroic comrades before him have made clear, there are many ways to fight back against a violent fascist regime. "Perhaps it's time for more of us to put our thinking caps on," Kelly wrote. Another far-left writer Betts interacted with was Emily Gosensky, a writer formerly known as Edward Gosensky. Gosensky gained notoriety among Antifa and left-wing circles for identifying and releasing the personal details of people she says are alt-right. She has also expressed support for extremism on social media. She calls for the far left to embrace weapons. This is an Antifa doctrine that appealed to Betts. One of the tweets he shared from Gosensky read, "What I'm saying is armed community self-defense is not only good, it's necessary." He retweeted another post by an anonymous Antifa account that read, "Anti-fascist action is self-defense. It is good, it is righteous, and it is necessary." In the final weeks of Betts' life, he promoted posts that demonized Texas Senator Ted Cruz and Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy's resolution against Antifa extremism. He shared numerous posts in support of Antifa, including one that had a photograph of the Antifa Iron Front symbol. He also retweeted content from Antifa accounts themselves, like Antifa International. Those who dismiss the mountain of evidence of Betts' Antifa views will say it existed only online. That is wrong. Betts put his militant Antifa beliefs into practice by volunteering as armed Black Bloc security. In May 2019, he was one of around 500 people who came to counter a tiny Ku Klux Klan rally in Courthouse Square in Dayton. He came masked and carried a modified pistol that is likely the same one he later used to kill in August. Hassan Karin, a person who personally knew Betts, told local media he bumped into Betts briefly and they talked. This revelation was not widely reported. Instead, the mainstream media focused on what high school peers remembered of Betts' alleged misogyny 7 years prior. The goal was to shift attention away from Antifa and onto other theories for the shooting. The FBI has still not revealed the findings of their investigation into Betts' shooting, but they did disclose that it was clear he had been exploring violent ideologies. The last tweets Betts liked on Twitter were responses to the El Paso shooting, which had just occurred hours before. The posts he liked called the attack domestic Nazi terrorism and linked the shooting to President Trump. A year after the El Paso mass shooting, the hashtag #ElPasoStrong trended on social media. It was created to remember and honor the victims of the far-right shooting. Many media outlets published stories of how Latinos were affected. However, a day later, no #DaytonStrong campaign materialized. This wasn't any surprise to me. Some victims are valued more in the eyes of the American media than others. Michael Reinol. In 2020, Portland, my hometown, was in the national and international news for all the wrong reasons again. Dozens of cities had Black Lives Matter-inspired protests or riots break out in response to George Floyd's death, but Portland stood out above all in that the violence was maintained for months. Spending time in Chaz in Seattle, I had already seen up close what happens when city officials make law enforcement retreat from the public. Anarchists and other extremists move in and establish their own rules. And they aren't shy about using violence. In fact, they revel in it. As in Chaz, those who fashion themselves security for racial justice are often the most violent, cruel, and brutal. On August 29th, 2020, 3 months into the daily violent protests in Portland, a 48-year-old volunteer security person for BLM Antifa killed a Trump supporter in downtown. Michael Forrest Reinol shot Aaron J. Danielson, 39, using a pistol at near point-blank range after lying in wait for him around a street corner. The shooting was caught on camera from a distance by a live streamer. A person believed to be Reinol shouted, "We've got a couple right here!" Two shots rang out, and Danielson fell face first to the ground. The shooting occurred in the context of left-wing versus right-wing clashes in Portland. Earlier in the day, hundreds of vehicles gathered in Clackamas County, near Portland, for a grassroots-organized Trump 2020 cruise rally. It was a mass vehicle caravan rally, celebrating all that Antifa hate: President Trump, America, and law enforcement. The day was peaceful as drivers made their way out of a mall's parking lot and onto a route that took them in and around the Portland area. But trouble was waiting when they decided to drive into downtown Portland. Drivers displaying the US, Trump, and Gadsden flags were met by crowds of masked Antifa rioters who came prepared with projectile weapons. Similarly, the drivers and their passengers were ready for confrontation with their own tools and weapons. Antifa rioters hurled eggs and rocks at the caravan participants. They also sprayed cars and passengers with urine from water guns. Some of them tried to stop the vehicles by standing in the road and pushing against the cars. In response, the caravan participants used pepper spray and shot people with paintballs. No one sustained real injuries, and it was another spectacle into the political clashes that have come to define Portland since 2016. By around 8:30 p.m., the caravan vehicles were gone, but some of its participants walked around. Aaron Danielson walked with his friend Chandler Pappas. Both had participated as passengers in the caravan earlier in the day and are affiliated with Patriot Prayer, the Portland area conservative group. According to the criminal complainted against Reinhold, at approximately 8:44 p.m., he was walking ahead of Danielson and Pappas. He looked back at them and reached toward his waistband. Portland police detective Rico Benigo wrote in the affidavit, "Reinhold turns into the garage entry and reaches toward his left front waist area. Reinhold conceals himself, waits, and watches as Danielson and Pappas continue walking by. Danielson and Pappas do not appear to interact or communicate with anyone and continue southbound on Southwest 3rd Avenue. After Danielson and Pappas walk by, Reinhold begins to emerge from garage while still reaching toward the pocket or pouch on his waistband. Subject 2 looks back toward Reinhold. Danielson and Pappas cross westbound across Southwest 3rd Avenue, and Reinhold and Subjects 2 follow them. The shooting occurs shortly thereafter and is not captured on the surveillance video. When news spread on social media that someone had been shot, Antifa accounts and Antifa-sympathetic journalists erroneously spread the claim that a black comrade had been killed by a Trump supporter. The far right have been building up to this for the last 3 weeks. The Portland Police Bureau encouraged this escalation, tweeted Rose City Antifa. Pop Mob tweeted, as we process our trauma over this tragic turn of events, let's remember the importance of standing together as a community in opposition to fascist violence. Within a few hours, it was revealed that the homicide victim was a conservative who vocally supported law enforcement and the president. Photos of Danielson's body on the ground showed he had a thin blue line patch on his clothing, a symbol of support for police, and a hat bearing the insignia of the Patriot Prayer Group. As soon as that news spread among Antifa, the somber mood in the crowd, which by now gathered outside the Justice Center, became celebratory. I just got word the person who died was a Patriot Prayer person. He was a fucking Nazi, shouted a woman on a bullhorn outside the federal courthouse. People shouted, yeah, in response. She continued, our community held its own and took out the trash. I am not going to shed any tears over a Nazi. Even though none of the Antifa knew the identity of the deceased at that time, it didn't matter. They only needed to know that he was a Trump supporter. They celebrated his death through dancing, song, and the burning of American flags. In the immediate hours after Danielson's murder, internet sleuths went to work analyzing the blurry stills showing Reinhold, who was unknown at the time, running from the scene in the live stream video. Based on his distinctive clothing, they found other clips from earlier in the evening showing him walking around downtown, at times pumping his fist in support of BLM and frequently having his hand ready on a concealed gun. What positively identified him to internet sleuths, as well as law enforcement, was a large tattoo of a black power fist on his neck. From there, people discovered a July 27th, 2020, Bloomberg News video interview featuring Reinhold. His face and tattoo are seen clearly. Crowdsourcing the investigation moved much quicker than what police were saying, who at that point had not even named Danielson as the victim yet. Meanwhile, the shooter was now on the run. Once I confirmed Reinhold's name, I immediately searched online for his social media accounts. Though most Antifa are quick to conceal and hide their online presence, Reinhold still had an active Instagram account where he had posted throughout the summer riots. Within seconds of skimming his posts, it confirmed what I suspected all along. Not only was he obsessively in support of BLM, he identified himself as 100% Antifa and wrote long posts about the need for violent revolution. On June 16th, 2020, Reinhold wrote, every revolution needs people that are willing and ready to fight. There are many of us protesters that are just protesting without a clue of where that will lead. That's just the beginning. That's where the fight starts. If that's as far and you can take it, thank you for your participation, but please stand aside and support the ones that are willing to fight. I am 100% Antifa all the way. I am willing to fight for my brothers and sisters, even if some of them are too ignorant to realize what Antifa truly stands for. We truly have an opportunity right now to fix everything, but it will be a fight like no other. It will be a war, and like all wars, there will be casualties. I was in the army, and I hated it. I did not feel like fighting for them would ever be a good cause. Today's protesters and Antifa are my brothers in arms. For the record, Reinhold did not serve in the US Army. His other posts on Instagram reflect the same themes of viewing the current riots as part of an armed struggle for revolution. Though he was never known to dress up in black bloc, what is important is that he espoused Antifa's ideology. While calling for the abolishment of police, Reinhold was auditioning for a role in what BLM Antifa would replace police with, armed community self-defense. Not only has this resulted in deadly consequences in Seattle's Chaz, others were nearly killed in Portland. On August 16th, 2020, an associate of Reinhold, Marquis Keese Love, was part of a BLM security detail in downtown Portland that patrolled the area around the Justice Center, as they had done for many weeks. The day had been marked by extremist speeches featuring local activists like Letha Winston, the mother of Patrick Kimmons. Kimmons, a 27-year-old gang-affiliated black Portlander, was shot and killed by Portland police in 2018 after shooting two people in downtown and aiming his handgun at responding cops. Since then, numerous BLM and Antifa-organized violent protests have been held in the city to demand justice for Kimmons, even though a Multnomah County grand jury determined the shooting was justified. Still, on August 16th, Kimmons's mother incited the crowd by telling them that, "This is a war, guys. We're getting ready to get armored up around here." She later added in her speech, "I know you cops got a gun, but so do I." That night, Marquis Love and a marauding security team that included other agitators chased a videographer from the Justice Center to the nearby 7-Eleven. There, they beat up a transgender woman. Two of the people who attempted to help her were Adam Hayner and his girlfriend, Tammy Martin. Both ended up getting beaten by the mob. Hayner was chased down in his car, causing it to crash in the middle of downtown. The security team then ran up to him and called him a racist and white supremacist while beating him. Marquis Love, wearing his vest with the word security on it, was recorded on video doing a roundhouse kick to Hayner's head that knocked him unconscious. Independent videographer Drew Hernandez recorded these beatings discreetly and at great risk to himself. His video showed Hayner laying unresponsive in a pool of his own blood. Hayner was taken to hospital and survived. Love is so far the only one convicted for that assault. Reinhold was part of this volunteer security crew with Love, though he did not appear to be present on the night Hayner was beaten. However, they have attacked others throughout July. Reinhold's Bloomberg News interview that helped the public and investigators identify him provided an account of how he got shot in the arm. On July 26, 2020, two men who wanted to observe the protests began recording on their phones in Lansdale Square, a public park that became the operations zone of BLM Antifa. One of the men, Aaron Scott Collins, was suddenly accused of being a Nazi, and the mob called for others to steal his phone. Collins was hit with a skateboard and knocked down. While he was on the ground, the security team tried to steal his handgun, which was legally owned. Reinhold was one of the people who tried to grab the pistol. Love was there as well. The gun discharged during the struggle, and Reinhold was grazed in the arm by the bullet. The security team continued to beat the two men and eventually stole Collins's gun. Collins was taken to hospital by ambulance, where he received treatment for a head and bleeding mouth injury. No one was ever arrested over the assault and robbery. In the Bloomberg video, Reinhold even admitted to not knowing what started the altercation when he decided to participate in the attack. The last few months of Reinhold's life before his deadly shooting show he was a violent man with no regard for the well-being of others. Over and over, authorities failed to prosecute or jail him, even when they had several opportunities to. This is the travesty in the killing of Danielson. It could have been prevented. Nearly 2 months before the killing of Danielson, Portland police actually had Reinhold in custody, but he was let go. On July 5th, 2020, during the start of violent riots outside the Mark O. Hatfield Federal Courthouse, Reinhold was detained and cited for possessing an illegal and loaded gun in a public place, resisting arrest and interfering with police. He was photographed fighting cops while they subdued him to the ground. In the photo, released by Portland police, his pistol is seen on the ground next to him. A source tells me that police released Reinhold because he claimed to be injured. The Multnomah County District Attorney's Office then dropped all of his charges for unknown reasons. But that wasn't the only missed opportunity to stop Reinhold. On June 8th, 2020, he and his teenage son were racing in separate vehicles in eastern Oregon. Reinhold was stopped by a state trooper who saw his 11-year-old daughter as the passenger. According to state police, they found prescription drugs, marijuana, and an illegally possessed loaded Glock pistol. Reinhold had a warrant for that arrest due to his failure to appear in court, but he was never apprehended. Authorities in Oregon missed 3 opportunities to arrest and prosecute Reinhold before he went on to kill. Just the day prior to the August 29th murder, he even attended the BLM Antifa riot outside Mayor Ted Wheeler's home. He was photographed with his young child, who was brandishing a baseball bat. Immediately after the killing, Reinhold went on the run. He fled out of state to Lacey, Washington, about 2 hours north by car. 5 days later, he emerged in a Vice News interview with sympathetic left-wing journalist Donovan Farley. In the interview from an undisclosed location, Reinhold admitted to the killing, saying, "I had no choice. I mean, I had a choice. I could have sat there and watched them kill a friend of mine of color, but I wasn't going to do that." He said that Danielson threatened him with a knife, even though no evidence supports the claim. In fact, the video surveillance, seconds before the shooting, showed him waiting for Danielson and following him. Reinhold also admitted to being a fugitive, saying he was not turning himself in because he thinks police are collaborating with right-wingers. As mentioned earlier, the rejection of police is a central tenet of Antifa ideology. They do not allow comrades to cooperate with law enforcement. The night that the rest of Reinhold's interview was set to air, I received word from law enforcement sources that U.S. Marshals had killed him in Washington State. A federal task force made up of local officers located Reinhold in an apartment. He was wanted for the second-degree murder of Danielson. The U.S. Marshals Service said Reinhold was killed after leaving the apartment armed with a handgun. As of this writing, it is unknown if he fired any shots. However, a .38-caliber pistol was confirmed found on his body. Like the Antifa killers who came before him, Reinhold was instantly made into a martyr by Antifa in Portland. The night he was killed, BLM Antifa rioters attacked a police building in southeast Portland. On the ground outside the police building, they graffitied over and over, "You murdered Michael Reinhold." On Twitter, the account belonging to NYC Antifa responded to his death by writing angrily, "What the actual fuck?" Antifa doxing activist Emily Gorsensky simply tweeted, "Fuck Nazis," echoing Reinhold's beliefs that motivated him to kill. The morning after, while driving around Portland, I saw a large graffiti message on the side of a police building that read, "Long live Mike."